on poetry and drama. Stendhal's The Charterhouse of Parma, in an Italian translation. A copy of Madame Bovary in the original French. Thomas Mann and Schiller in German. Juna Barnes and Virginia Woolf in English. I took down a copy of Mal d'Aurore by Isidore Ducasse. The pages were dog-eared and heavily annotated in Carla's own hand. I took out another book, a German translation of Gogol's Dead Souls, and it too bore Carla's handwritten notes on many pages. She consumed her books, I saw. She devoured her books, and was unafraid to mark them, even to scar them, with her own comments and system of references. A row of journals, similar to the one I'd discovered on the desk, occupied half of one shelf, some 20 books in all. I took one of them down and flipped through it. The fact that it, like the others, was written in English struck me for the first time. She was born in Switzerland, and she was fluent in German and French, I knew. But when she wrote out her most intimate thoughts and feelings, she used English. I seized on that, telling myself that there were good and hopeful signs in it. English was my language. She spoke to herself from her heart, in my language. I moved around the apartment, studying the things she chose to surround herself with in her private living space. There was an oil painting of women carrying water from a river, with matkes balanced on their heads, and children following with smaller pots on their own heads. Prominently displayed on a dedicated shelf was a hand-carved rosewood figure of the goddess Durga. It was surrounded by incense holders. I noticed an arrangement of everlastings and other dried flowers. They were my own favourites, and very unusual in a city where fresh flowers were plentiful and inexpensive. There was a collection of found objects, a huge frond from a date palm that she'd picked up somewhere and fixed to one wall, shells and river stones that filled a large and waterless fish tank, a discarded spinning wheel on which she'd draped a collection of small brass temple bells. The most colourful articles in the apartment, her clothes, hung from an open rack in one corner of her room rather than in a wardrobe. The clothes were divided into two distinct groups, left and right of the rack. On the left were her networking clothes, smart suits with long, narrow skirts, and the silver sheath of a backless evening dress, among other glamorous dresses. On the right were her private clothes, the loose silk trousers, flowing scarves, and long-sleeved cotton blouses that she wore by choice. Under the rack of clothes was a row of shoes, 2 dozen pairs. At the end of the row were my boots, newly polished and laced up to their tops. I knelt to pick them up. Her shoes looked so small next to my own that I took one of them up instead and held it in my hands for a moment. It was Italian, from Milano, in dark green leather, and with a decorative buckle stitched to the side and looped around the low heel. It was an elegant, expensive shoe, but the heel was worn down slightly on one side, and the leather was scuffed in a few places. I saw that she, or someone, had tried to disguise the pale scratches by drawing over them with a felt-tipped pen that was almost, but not quite, the right shade of green. I found my clothes in a plastic bag behind the boots. They'd been laundered and folded neatly. I took them and changed into them in the bathroom. I held my head under the cold water tap for a full minute. Dressed in my old jeans and comfortable boots, and with my short hair pushed back into its familiar messy disorder, I felt refreshed and my spirits revived. I returned to the bedroom to check on Lisa. She was sleeping contentedly. A diffident smile flickered on her lips. I tucked the sheet into the sides of the bed to prevent her from falling and adjusted the overhead fan to a minimum speed. The windows were barred and the front door snapped to the lock position when it was shut from outside. I knew that I could leave her there and she would be safe. As I stood beside the bed, watching the rise and fall of her chest in its sleeping rhythm, I thought about leaving a note for Carla. I decided against it because I wanted her to wonder about me. to ask herself what I'd been thinking and what I'd done there, in her house. To give myself an excuse to see her, I folded the clothes she'd given me, the dead lover's burial clothes that I'd just discarded, and put them in a plastic bag. I planned to wash them and return with them in a few days. I turned to wake Tariq for our journey home, but the boy was standing in the doorway, clutching his small shoulder bag. His sleepy face wore a look of hurt and accusation.
"You won't leave me?" he asked.
"No," I laughed. "But you'd be a lot better off if I did. More comfortable, anyway. My place isn't as nice as this." He frowned, puzzled by the English words, and not at all reassured. "Are you ready?"
"Yes, ready,"
he mumbled, wagging his head from side to side. Thinking of the latrine and the lack of water at the slum, I told him to use the bathroom before we went, and directed him to wash his face and hands well. After he'd used the toilet, I gave him a glass of milk and a sweet cake that I found in Carla's kitchen. We stepped out into the deserted street and pulled the door locked behind us. He looked back at the house and at all the buildings around it, searching for landmarks that would fix the place in his mental map. Then he fell into step, beside but a little apart from me. We walked on the road because the footpaths were occupied in many places by sleeping pavement dwellers. The only traffic was the occasional taxi or police jeep. Every shop and business was closed, and only a few houses or apartments showed light at their windows. The moon was almost full, but obscured from time to time by dense, brooding drifts of cloud. They were harbingers of the monsoon, the clouds that gathered and thickened every night and would swell within the following days until every part of the sky was clogged with them, and it would rain everywhere and forever. We made good time. Only half an hour after leaving Carla's apartment, we turned onto the wide track that skirted the eastern curve of the slum. Tariq had said nothing on the walk, and I, burdened by worry about how to cope with him and the responsibility for his welfare, burdened by the boy himself, it seemed to me then, kept a churlish silence. On our left, there was a large open area about the size of a soccer field that was set aside as a latrine zone, where women, young children and elderly people went to relieve themselves. Nothing grew there, and the whole area was dusty and bare after 8 months of continuous sunshine. On our right was the fringe of the construction site, marked here and there by low piles of timber, latticed steel and other materials. Single bulbs, suspended from long extension wires, lit the mounds of supplies. There was no other light on the path, and the slum, still some 500 metres away, showed only faint glimmers from a few kerosene lamps. I told Tariq to follow my steps precisely, knowing that many people used the track as a latrine after dark because they were afraid of rats or snakes in the open field. By some mysterious unspoken consensus, a narrow and erratic path was always left clean along the course of the track, so that latecomers might enter the slum without stepping in the filth that accumulated. I came home late at night so often that I'd learned how to negotiate the eccentric meander of that clean path, without stumbling or tripping on the edges of the many large potholes that no one ever seemed inclined to repair. Tariq followed me closely, struggling dutifully to step exactly where I'd walked. The stench there at the edge of the slum was overpowering and sickening for a stranger, I knew. I'd grown accustomed to it, and had even come to think of it with a kind of affection, as slum dwellers did. That smell meant we were home, safe, protected by our collective wretchedness, from the dangers that haunted poor people in the cleaner, grander city streets. Yet I never forgot the spasms of nausea I'd endured when I first entered the slum as a stranger. And I remembered the fear I'd felt, in that smear of air so foul it seemed to poison my lungs with every breath and stain the very sweat on my skin. I remembered, and I knew that Tariq was surely suffering and sickened and afraid. But I said nothing to comfort him, and I refused the impulse to take his hand. I didn't want the child with me, and I was furious with myself for being too weak to tell Kadarbai as much. I wanted the boy to be sickened. I wanted him to be afraid. I wanted him so sickened and afraid and unhappy that he would plead with his uncle to take him from me. The crackling tension of that cruel silence was shattered by a burst of ferocious barking. The howls of that one dog soon stirred violent barking from several, and then many others. I stopped suddenly, and Tariq bumped into me from behind. The dogs were in the open field, and not far away. I peered into the blackness, but I couldn't see them. I sensed that it was a large pack, and spread out over a wide area. I looked to the mass of huts, calculating the distance to the slum and the safety of its buildings. Just then, the baying howls reached a crescendo of violence, and they came trotting at us out of the night. 20, 30, 40 maddened dogs formed the pack that advanced on us in a wide crescent, cutting off our retreat to the slum. The danger was extreme. Those dogs that were so cowed and obsequious in the daylight hours formed themselves into vicious feral packs at night. Their aggression and ferocity was legendary in all the slums throughout the city and inspired great fear. Attacks upon human beings were common. I treated dog bites and rat bites almost every day in the little clinic at my hut. A drunken man had been savaged by a pack of dogs on the edge of the slum and was still recovering in hospital. A young child had been killed in that very spot only a month before. His small body had been torn to pieces, and the fragments were strewn across such a wide area that it had taken the whole of a long day to locate and retrieve them all. We were stranded on the dark path. The dogs closed to within a few meters, swarming around us and barking furiously. The noise was deafening and terrifying. The bravest of the hounds inched closer and closer. I knew they were only seconds from making the first snapping rush at us. The slum was too far away to reach safely. I thought I could make it alone, suffering a few bites. But I knew the dogs would cut Tariq down in the first 100 meters. Much closer, there was a pile of timbers and other construction materials. It would give us weapons and a well-lit area for the fight. I told Tariq to prepare himself to run on my command. When I was sure he understood, I threw the plastic bag containing the clothes Carla had loaned me into the midst of the pack. They fell on it at once, snapping and snarling at one another in their frenzy to rip and tear at it. "Now, Tariq, now!" I shouted, shoving the boy in front of me and turning to cover his retreat. The dogs were so engrossed in the bundle that we were safe for a moment. I ran to the pile of scrap wood and snatched up a length of stout bamboo, just as the pack tired of the shredded bundle and advanced on us again. Recognizing the weapon, the enraged hounds hesitated a little further from us. They were many. "Too many," I heard myself thinking. "There's too many of them." It was the largest pack I'd ever seen. The wild howling goaded the most maddened of them to make a series of rushing feints from several directions. I raised the solid stick and told Tariq to climb onto my back. The boy did so at once, clambering up piggyback style and wrapping his thin arms around my neck tightly. The pack crept closer. One black dog, larger than the rest, made a scrambling run with its jaws wide and aimed at my legs. I brought the stick down with all my strength, missing the snout but smashing it into the animal's spine. It yelped in agony and scuttled out of range. The battle began. One after another, from left, right, and in front of us, they attacked. Each time I lashed out with the stick to repulse them. It occurred to me that if I managed to cripple or even kill one of the dogs, the others might be frightened off. But none of the blows I landed was serious enough to discourage them for very long. In fact, they seemed to sense that the stick could hurt them but not kill them, and they grew bolder. The whole pack crept inexorably closer. The individual attacks came more often. 10 minutes into the struggle, I was sweating heavily and beginning to tire. I knew it wouldn't be long before my reflexes slowed, and one of the dogs slipped through to bite my leg or arm. And with the first smell of blood, their ravening fury would become rabid, berserk and fearless. I hoped that someone in the slum would hear the ear-splitting clamour and come to our rescue. But I'd been woken by that same barking from the outskirts of the slum 100 times late at night. And 100 times I'd turned over and gone back to sleep without thinking about it. The large black dog that seemed to be the pack leader made a cunning double feint. As I turned, too quickly, to meet its rush, my foot struck a projecting timber and I fell. I'd often heard people say that at the moment of some accident or sudden danger, they had the sensation that time was delayed or sluggish, and everything seemed to happen in slow motion. That tumble sideways, as I fell to the ground, was my first experience of it. Between stumble and fall, there was a tunnel of lengthened time and narrowed perspectives. I saw the black dog hesitate in the rhythm of its instinctive retreats and turn to face us once more. I saw its forepaws slip and slide beneath it with the energy of its scrambling turn, and then gouge out a purchase on the dusty track for the rush and spring. I saw the eyes of the beast, the almost human cruelty, as it sensed my weakness and its nearness to the killing second. I saw the other dogs pause, almost as one, and then creep forward with little mincing steps. I had time to think how strange and inappropriate their stealth was, then, in the moments of my vulnerability. I had time to feel the rough stones scrape the skin back from my elbow as I struck the ground, and time to wonder at the ridiculous particle of worry about the threat of infection that strayed across the surface of the present and greater danger of the dogs. The dogs! They were everywhere. And desperate, sickened with fear for him, I thought of Tariq, the poor child who'd been pressed into my care so reluctantly. I felt him slip from my neck, felt his fragile arms fall through my scrambling hands as I crashed into the slithering pile of timber. I watched him fall and scramble forward with feline agility to stand, one foot on either side of my extended legs. Then, his body rigid with the vehemence of his rage and courage, the little boy shrieked, seized a lump of wood, and crashed it down on the snout of the black dog. The beast was sorely wounded. Its yelping screams rose above the din of barks and howls and the shrieking of the boy.
"Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar!"
Tariq shouted. He crouched and swung at the empty air, his own face wild as any beast, and his posture as feral. In the last of those impossibly long seconds of my heightened sense, I had time to feel the hot sting of tears as I watched him crouch and swing and fight to defend us. I could see the knuckles of his spine thrust out against his shirt and the bones of his thin little knees outlined against his trousers. There was so much bravery in that small package. The emotion that burned my eyes was love, the pure, pride-filled love of father for son. I loved him with all my heart in that second. As I thrashed up to my feet, and time accelerated from its glue of fear and failure, some words repeated themselves in my mind. Words from Carla's poem. I will die for this love. Die for this love. Tariq had wounded the pack leader, and it hung back behind the others, dispiriting them for a few moments. The howling grew louder, however, and there was another quality to it then. A throbbing moan of frustration. It was as if they were sickening for the kill and tormented by their failure. I hoped that in their agony of disappointment, they might turn on one another if they didn't bring us down soon. Then, without warning, they sprang at us again. They came in groups of 2 and 3. They attacked from 2 sides at once. The boy and I stood side to side and back to back, fighting them off with desperate jabs and slashes. The dogs were insane with the bloodlust. We hit them hard, but they cowered only seconds before leaping at us again. Everywhere around us was fang and snarl, snap and howl. I leaned over Tariq to help him drive back a determined rush from 3 or 4 of the beasts, and one dog managed to sprint in behind me and bite down hard on my ankle. My leather boot protected me, and I drove the dog away, but I knew we were losing the war. We'd retreated hard up against the mound of timbers, and there was nowhere else to go. The whole pack was snarling and lunging at us from only 2 meters away. Then, from behind us, there was a sound of growling and the crunching rattle of timbers slipping away under the weight of something that had jumped onto them. I thought that some of the dogs had somehow worked their way around onto the heap. But as I turned to meet the challenge, I saw the black-clad figure of Abdullah as he sprang, leaping over our heads, into the midst of the thrashing jaws of the pack. He whirled, striking out left and right. He jumped, drawing his knees up tight and landing with the supple tautness of a trained fighter. His movements were fluid, swift, and economical. It was the awful and beautiful frugality of snake and scorpion. Lethal, exact, perfect. He'd armed himself with a metal rod, about 3 centimeters in diameter and more than 1 meter in length. He swung it two-handed as if it was a sword. But it wasn't the superior weapon, or even his uncanny agility, that terrified the dogs and drove them back. What routed them in panicked flight, leaving 2 of their number skull-cracked dead, was the fact that he'd taken the fight to them, that he'd attacked where we'd defended, that he was sure of winning, where we'd merely struggled to survive. It was over quickly. There was silence, where so much sound had screamed. Abdullah turned to look at us with the metal rod held above his shoulder, like a samurai sword. The smile shining from his brave young face was like moonlight gleaming on the minaret of Haji Ali's white mosque. Later, while we drank hot and very sweet Suleimani chai in my hut, Abdullah explained that he'd been waiting for me in the hut and heard the dogs. He told us he came to investigate it because he'd sensed that something was dreadfully wrong. When we'd talked the adventure through several times, I prepared 3 places for us on the bare earth floor, and we stretched out to rest. Abdullah and Tariq slipped effortlessly into a sleep that eluded me. I lay back in a darkness that smelt of incense and beady cigarettes and cheap kerosene, and I sifted the events of the last few days through a sieve of doubt and suspicion. So much more had happened during those days, it seemed, than in the months before them. Madame Jo, Carla, Kaderbai's council, Shapna. I felt myself to be at the mercy of personalities that were stronger, or at least more mysterious, than my own. I felt the irresistible draw and drift of a tide that was carrying me to someone else's destination, someone else's destiny. There was a plan or purpose. I sensed it. There were clues, I was sure, but I couldn't separate them from the busy collage of hours and faces and words. The cloud-mottled night seemed full of signs and portents, as if fate itself was warning me to go, or daring me to stay. Tariq woke with a start and sat up, staring about him. My eyes were adjusted to the darkness. I saw the moment of fear on his pale face clearly, a fear that tightened into sorrow and resolve, even as I watched. He looked to the peacefully sleeping form of Abdullah, and then to me. Without a sound, he stood and dragged his sleeping mat over until it met mine. Snuggling down under the cover of his thin blanket once more, he cuddled in beside me. I stretched out my arm, and he rested his head on it. The smell of the sun was in his hair. As exhaustion finally claimed me, submerging my doubts and confusions, the shrewd clarity of near sleep suddenly showed me what it was that those new friends, Kaderbai, Carla, Abdullah, Prabhaka, and all the others, had in common. They were all, we were all, strangers to the city. None of us was born here. All of us were refugees, survivors, pitched up on the shores of the island city. If there was a bond between us, it was the bond of exiles, the kinship of the lost, the lonely, and the dispossessed. Realizing that, understanding it, made me see the hard edges of the way I'd treated the boy, Tariq, himself a stranger in my raw and ragged fragment of the city. Ashamed of the cold selfishness that had stolen my pity, and pierced by the courage and loneliness of the little boy, I listened to his sleeping breath and let him cling to the ache in my heart. Sometimes we love with nothing more than hope. Sometimes we cry with everything except tears. In the end, that's all there is. Love and its duty, sorrow and its truth. In the end, that's all we have. To hold on tight until the dawn. Part 3. Chapter 17.
The world is run by 1 million evil men, 10 million stupid men, and 100 million cowards, Abdul Ghani pronounced in his best Oxford English accent, licking the sweet honey cake from his short, thick fingers. The evil men are the power, the rich men and the politicians and the fanatics of religion, whose decisions rule the world and set it on its course of greed and destruction.
He paused, looking toward the whispering fountain in Abdelkader Khan's rain-splashed courtyard, as if he was receiving inspiration from the wetness and the shimmering stone. He reached out with his right hand and took another honey cake, popping it whole into his mouth. The little beseeching smile he gave me as he chewed and swallowed seemed to say, "I know I shouldn't, but I really can't help it."
"There are only 1 million of them, the truly evil men, in the whole world. The very rich and the very powerful, whose decisions really count, they only number 1 million. The stupid men, who number 10 million, are the soldiers and policemen who enforce the rule of the evil men. They are the standing armies of 12 key countries and the police forces of those and 20 more. In total, there are only 10 million of them with any real power or consequence. They're often brave, I'm sure, but they are stupid too, because they give their lives for governments and causes that use their flesh and blood as mere chess pieces. Those governments always betray them, or let them down, or abandon them in the long run. Nations neglect no men more shamefully than the heroes of their wars."
The circular courtyard garden at the heart of Kadarbai's house was open to the sky at its center. Monsoon rain fell upon the fountain and surrounding tiles. Rain so dense and constant that the sky was a river, and our part of the world was its waterfall. Despite the rain, the fountain was still running, sending its frail plumes of water upward against the cascade from above. We sat under cover of the surrounding veranda roof, dry and warm in the humid air, as we watched the downpour and sipped sweet tea.
"And the 100 million cowards," Abdul Ghani continued,
pinching the handle of the teacup between his plump fingers.
"They are the bureaucrats and paper shufflers and pen pushers who permit the rule of the evil men and look the other way. They are the head of this department and the secretary of that committee and the president of the other association. They are managers and officials and mayors and officers of the court. They always defend themselves by saying that they are just following orders or just doing their job, and it's nothing personal. And if they don't do it, someone else surely will. They are the 100 million cowards who know what is going on, but say nothing, while they sign the paper that puts one man before a firing squad or condemns 1 million men to the slower death of a famine."
He fell silent, staring into the mandala of veins on the back of his hand. A few moments later, he shook himself from his reverie and looked at me, his eyes gleaming in a gentle, affectionate smile.
"So, that's it," he concluded.
"The world is run by 1 million evil men, 10 million stupid men, and 100 million cowards. The rest of us, all 6 billion of us, do pretty much what we are told." He laughed and slapped at his thigh. It was a good laugh, the kind of laugh that won't rest until it shares the joke, and I found myself laughing with him.
Do you know what this means, my boy?
He asked, when his face was serious enough to frame the question.
Tell me. This formula, the 1 million, the 10 million, the 100 million, this is the real truth of all politics. Marx was wrong. It is not a question of classes, you see, because all the classes are in the hands of this tiny few. This set of numbers is the cause of empire and rebellion. This is the formula that has generated our civilizations for the last 10,000 years. This built the pyramids. This launched your crusades. This put the world at war. And this formula has the power to impose the peace.
They're not my crusades, I corrected him. But I get your point.
Do you love him?
He asked, changing the subject so swiftly that he took me by surprise. He did that so often, shifting the ground of his discourses from theme to theme, that it was one of the hallmarks of his conversation. His skill at performing the trick was such that even when I came to know him well, even when I came to expect those sudden deviations and deflections, he still managed to catch me off guard.
Do you love Kadarbai?
What sort of a question is that? I demanded, still laughing.
He has great affection for you, Lin. He speaks of you often.
I frowned and looked away from his penetrating gaze. It gave me a rush of intense pleasure to hear that Kadarbai liked me and spoke of me. Still, I didn't want to admit, even to myself, how much his approval meant to me. The play of conflicting emotions, love and suspicion, admiration and resentment, confused me, as it usually did when I thought of Kadar Khan or spent time with him. The confusion emerged as irritation in my eyes and in my voice. How long do you think we'll have to wait? I asked, looking around at the closed doors that led to the private rooms of Kadarbai's house. I have to meet with some German tourists this afternoon. Abdul ignored the question and leaned across the little table separating our two chairs.
You must love him, he said in an almost seductive whisper. Do you want to know why I love Abdelkader with my life?
We were sitting with our faces close enough for me to see the fine red veins in the whites of his eyes. The embroidery of those red fibres converged on the auburn iris of his eyes, like so many fingers raised to support the golden red-brown discs. Beneath the eyes were thick, heavy pouches, which gave his face its persistent expression of an inwardness filled with grieving and sorrow. Despite his many jokes and easy laughter, the pouches beneath his eyes were swollen, always, with a reservoir of unshed tears. We'd been waiting half an hour for Kadarbai to return. When I'd arrived with Tariq, Kader had greeted me warmly and then retired with the boy to pray, leaving me in the company of Abdul Ghani. The house was utterly silent, save for the splash of falling rain in the courtyard and the bubble of the fountain's overburdened pump. A pair of doves huddled together on the far side of the courtyard. Abdul and I stared at one another in the silence, but I didn't speak. I didn't answer his question. Do you want to know why I love this man? Of course I wanted to know. I was a writer. I wanted to know everything. But I wasn't so happy to play Ghani's question and answer game. I couldn't read him, and I couldn't guess where it was going.
I love him, my boy, because he is a mooring post in this city. Thousands of people find safety by tying their lives to his. I love him because he has the task where other men do not even have the dream of changing the whole world. I worry that he puts too much time and effort and money into that cause, and I have disagreed with him many times about it. But I love him for his devotion to it. And most of all, I love him because he is the only man I ever met. He is the only man you will ever meet who can answer the three big questions.
There are only three big questions? I asked, unable to keep the sarcasm from my voice.
Yes, he answered equably. Where did we come from? Why are we here? Where are we going? Those are the three big questions. And if you love him, Lin, my young friend, if you love him, he will tell you these secrets as well. He will tell you the meaning of life. And when you hear him speak, when you listen to him, you will know that what he says is true. And no one else you will ever meet will answer these three questions for you. I know. I have traveled the earth many times over. I have asked all the great teachers. Before I met Abdelkader Khan and joined my life to his as his brother, I spent a fortune, several fortunes, seeking out the famous seers and mystics and renowned scientists. None of them ever answered the three big questions. Then I met Kader Bhai. He answered the questions for me. And I have loved him as my brother, my soul's brother, ever since that day. I have served him from that day until the little minute that we share. He will tell you the meaning of life. He will solve the mystery for you. Ghani's voice was a new current in the wide, strong river that carried me, the river of the city and its 15 million lives. His thick brown hair was streaked with grey and smudged completely white at the temples. His moustache, more grey than brown, rested on finely sculptured, almost feminine lips. A heavy gold chain gleamed at his neck in the afternoon light and matched the gold that flashed in his eyes. And as we stared at one another, in that yearning silence, tears began to fill the red-rimmed cups of his eyes. I couldn't doubt the real depth of his feeling, but I couldn't fully understand it either. Then a door opened behind us, and Ghani's round face dissolved into its usual mask of facetious affability. We both turned to see Kader Bhai enter with Tariq.
"Lin," he said, with his hands resting on the boy's shoulders. "Tariq has been telling us how much he learned with you in the last 3 months."
3 months. At first I'd thought it impossible to endure the boy's company for 3 days. Yet 3 months had passed too swiftly, and when the time came to bring him home, I'd returned him to his uncle against the wishes of my heart. I knew that I would miss him. He was a good boy. He would be a fine man. The kind of man I once had tried and failed to be.
"He'd still be with us if you hadn't sent for him," I replied. There was a hint of reproach in my tone.
It seemed to me a cruel arbitrariness that, without warning, had put the boy with me for months and had taken him away just as suddenly.
"Tariq completed his training at our Quranic school during the last 2 years, and now he has improved his English with you. It is time for him to take his place at college, and I think he is very well prepared."
Kader Bhai's tone was gentle and patient. The affectionate and slightly amused smile in his eyes held me as firmly as his strong hands held the shoulders of the solemn, unsmiling boy standing in front of him.
"You know, Lin," he said softly, "we have a saying in the Pashto language, and the meaning of it is that you are not a man until you give your love truly and freely to a child. And you are not a good man until you earn the love, truly and freely, of a child in return."
"Tariq's okay," I said, standing to shake hands and take my leave. "He's a good kid, and I'll miss him." I wasn't the only one who would miss him. He was a favorite with Qasim Ali Hussein. The head man had visited the boy often and had taken him on his rounds of the slum. Jitendra and Radha had spoiled him with their affection. Johnny Sagar and Prabhakar had teased him good-naturedly, and they'd included him in their weekly cricket game. Even Abdullah had developed an emotional regard for the child. After the night of the wild dogs, he'd visited Tariq twice every week to teach him the arts of fighting with sticks, scarves, and bare hands. I saw them often during those months, their silhouettes carved on the horizon like figures from a shadow play, as they practiced on the one small strip of sandy beach near the slum. I shook hands with Tariq last and looked into his earnest, truthful black eyes.
Memories from the last 3 months skipped across the fluid surface of the moment. I recalled his first fight with one of the slum boys. A much bigger boy had knocked him down, but Tariq drove him back with the power of his eyes alone, forcing shame into the boy with his stare. The other boy broke down and wept. Tariq embraced him in a solicitous hug, and their close friendship was sealed. I remembered Tariq's enthusiasm in the English classes that I'd set up for him, and how he soon became my assistant, helping the other children who joined in to learn. I saw him struggling against the first monsoon flood with us, digging a drainage channel out of the rocky earth with sticks and our bare hands. I remembered his face peeping around the flimsy door of my hut one afternoon when I was trying to write. "Yes, what is it, Tariq?" I'd asked him irritably. "Oh, I'm sorry," he'd replied. "Do you want to be lonely?" I left Abdelkader Khan's house and began the long walk back to the slum, alone and diminished by the absence of the boy. I was less important somehow, or suddenly less valuable in the different world that closed in on me without him. I kept my appointment with the German tourists at their hotel, quite near Kadarbai's mosque. They were a young couple on their first trip to the subcontinent. They wanted to save money by changing their Deutschmarks on the black market, and then buy some hashish for their journey around India. They were a decent, happy couple, innocent, generous-hearted, and motivated by a spiritual notion of India. I changed their money for them, on a commission, and arranged the purchase of the charis. They were very grateful and tried to pay me more than we'd agreed. I refused the extra money. A deal is a deal, after all. And then accepted their invitation to smoke with them. The chillum I prepared was average strength for those of us who lived and worked on the streets of Bombay, but much stronger than they were accustomed to smoking. They were both stoned to sleep when I pulled the door of their hotel room closed and walked on through dozy afternoon streets. I made my way along Muhammad Ali Road to Mahatma Gandhi Road and the Colaba Causeway. I could have taken a bus or one of the many prowling taxis, but I loved the walk. I loved those kilometres from Chaur Bazaar, past Crawford Market, VT Station, Flora Fountain, the Fort area, Regal Circle, and on through Colaba to Sassoon Dock, the World Trade Centre, and the Back Bay. I walked them 1,000 times in those years, and they were always new, always exciting, and always inspiring. As I rounded Regal Circle and paused momentarily to check the coming attractions posters outside Regal Cinema, I heard a voice calling my name.
"Lin Baba! Hey! Oh, Lin!"
I turned to see Prabhakar leaning from the passenger window of a black and yellow taxi. I walked over to shake his hand and greet the driver, Prabhakar's cousin, Shantu.
"We're going back to home. Jump yourself inside and we'll give you a lift."
"Thanks, Prabhu," I smiled. "I'll keep walking. I've got a couple of stops to make along the way."
"Okay, Lin," Prabhakar grinned. "But you don't take too much time. Like sometimes too much time you're taking, if you don't mind that I'm telling your face. Today is a special day, isn't it?"
I waved until his smile disappeared in the thicket of traffic. But then I jumped in fright as a car slammed to a screeching smash beside me. An ambassador had tried to overtake a slower car and had crashed into a wooden handcart, forcing the heavy cart into the side of a taxi, only 2 meters away from me. It was a bad accident. The handcart puller was seriously injured. I could see that the ropes attached to his neck and shoulders, the reins and harness, had trapped him in the yoke of the cart. His body, constrained by the ropes, had somersaulted, and he'd hit his head hard on the unyielding surface of the road. One arm was twisted backward at a sickeningly unnatural angle. A piece of shinbone on one leg protruded below the knee. And those ropes, the very ropes he used every day to drag his cart through the city, were tangled about his neck and chest, and dragging him toward choking death. I rushed forward with others, pulling my knife from its scabbard in the belt at the back of my trousers. Working fast, but as carefully as possible, I cut through the ropes and freed the man from the wreckage of his cart. He was an older man, perhaps 60 years old, but he was fit and lean and healthy. His fast heartbeat was regular and strong, a powerful current with which to charge his recovery. His airways were clear and he was breathing easily. When I opened his eyes gently with my fingers, his pupils reacted to the light. He was dazed and shocked rather than unconscious. With three other men, I lifted him from the road to the footpath. His left arm hung limply from its shoulder, and I eased it into a curve at the elbow. Onlookers donated their handkerchiefs when I called for them. Using four of the handkerchiefs, attached at the corners, I confined the arm to his chest in a makeshift sling. I was examining the break in his leg when a frenzy of screaming and shouts near the damaged cars forced me to my feet. 10 or more men were trying to seize the driver of the Ambassador. He was a huge man, well over 6 feet, half again as heavy as I was, and twice as broad across the chest. He planted his thick legs against the floor of the vehicle, braced one arm against the roof, and gripped the steering wheel with the other. The furious crowd gave up after a minute of fruitless, desperate struggle, and turned their attention to the man in the back seat. He was a stocky man with strong shoulders, but he was much slighter and leaner. The mob dragged him from the back seat and thrust him against the side of the car. He covered his face with his arms, but the crowd began beating him with their fists and tearing at him with their fingers. The two men were Africans. I guessed them to be Nigerians. Watching from the footpath, I remembered the shock and shame I'd felt when I'd seen mob rage like that for the first time, almost 18 months before, on the first day of Prabhakar's dark tour of the city. I remembered how helpless and cowardly I'd felt when the crowd had carried the man's broken body away. I told myself then that it wasn't my culture, it wasn't my city, it wasn't my fight. 18 months later, the Indian culture was mine, and that part of the city was my own. It was a black market beat, my beat. I worked there every day. I even knew some of the people in the murderous crowd. I couldn't let it happen again without trying to help. Shouting louder than the rest, I ran into the screaming crowd and began dragging men away from the tight press of bodies. "Brothers! Brothers! Don't hit! Don't kill! Don't hit!" I shouted in Hindi. Ghani's voice was a new current in the wide, strong river that carried me, the river of the city and its 15 million lives. His thick brown hair was streaked with grey and smudged completely white at the temples. His moustache, more grey than brown, rested on finely sculptured, almost feminine lips. A heavy gold chain gleamed at his neck in the afternoon light and matched the gold that flashed in his eyes. And as we stared at one another in that yearning silence, tears began to fill the red-rimmed cups of his eyes. I couldn't doubt the real depth of his feeling, but I couldn't fully understand it either. Then a door opened behind us, and Ghani's round face dissolved into its usual mask of facetious affability. We both turned to see Kadarbai enter with Tariq.
"Lin," he said, with his hands resting on the boy's shoulders. "Tariq has been telling us how much he learned with you in the last 3 months."
3 months. At first I'd thought it impossible to endure the boy's company for 3 days. Yet 3 months had passed too swiftly, and when the time came to bring him home, I'd returned him to his uncle against the wishes of my heart. I knew that I would miss him. He was a good boy. He would be a fine man. The kind of man I once had tried and failed to be. "He'd still be with us if you hadn't sent for him," I replied. There was a hint of reproach in my tone. It seemed to me a cruel arbitrariness that, without warning, had put the boy with me for months and had taken him away just as suddenly.
"Tariq completed his training at our Quranic school during the last 2 years, and now he has improved his English with you. It is time for him to take his place at college, and I think he is very well prepared."
Kadarbai's tone was gentle and patient. The affectionate and slightly amused smile in his eyes held me as firmly as his strong hands held the shoulders of the solemn, unsmiling boy standing in front of him.
You know, Lin, he said softly. We have a saying in the Pashto language, and the meaning of it is that you are not a man until you give your love truly and freely to a child. And you are not a good man until you earn the love truly and freely of a child in return.
Tariq's okay, I said, standing to shake hands and take my leave. He's a good kid, and I'll miss him. I wasn't the only one who would miss him. He was a favorite with Qasim Ali Hussein. The head man had visited the boy often and had taken him on his rounds of the slum. Jitendra and Radha had spoiled him with their affection. Johnny Sagar and Prabhakar had teased him good-naturedly, and they'd included him in their weekly cricket game. Even Abdullah had developed an emotional regard for the child. After the night of the wild dogs, he'd visited Tariq twice every week to teach him the arts of fighting with sticks, scarves, and bare hands. I saw them often during those months, their silhouettes carved on the horizon like figures from a shadow play, as they practiced on the one small strip of sandy beach near the slum. I shook hands with Tariq last and looked into his earnest, truthful black eyes. Memories from the last 3 months skipped across the fluid surface of the moment. I recalled his first fight with one of the slum boys. A much bigger boy had knocked him down, but Tariq drove him back with the power of his eyes alone, forcing shame into the boy with his stare. The other boy broke down and wept. Tariq embraced him in a solicitous hug, and their close friendship was sealed. I remembered Tariq's enthusiasm in the English classes that I'd set up for him, and how he soon became my assistant, helping the other children who joined in to learn. I saw him struggling against the first monsoon flood with us, digging a drainage channel out of the rocky earth with sticks and our bare hands. I remembered his face peeping around the flimsy door of my hut one afternoon when I was trying to write. "Yes, what is it, Tariq?" I'd asked him irritably. "Oh, I'm sorry," he'd replied. "Do you want to be lonely?" I left Abdelkader Khan's house and began the long walk back to the slum, alone and diminished by the absence of the boy. I was less important somehow, or suddenly less valuable in the different world that closed in on me without him. I kept my appointment with the German tourists at their hotel, quite near Kadarbai's mosque. They were a young couple on their first trip to the subcontinent. They wanted to save money by changing their Deutschmarks on the black market, and then buy some hashish for their journey around India. They were a decent, happy couple, innocent, generous-hearted, and motivated by a spiritual notion of India. I changed their money for them, on a commission, and arranged the purchase of the charis. They were very grateful and tried to pay me more than we'd agreed. I refused the extra money. A deal is a deal, after all. And then accepted their invitation to smoke with them. The chillum I prepared was average strength for those of us who lived and worked on the streets of Bombay, but much stronger than they were accustomed to smoking. They were both stoned to sleep when I pulled the door of their hotel room closed and walked on through dozy afternoon streets. I made my way along Muhammad Ali Road to Mahatma Gandhi Road and the Colaba Causeway. I could have taken a bus or one of the many prowling taxis, but I loved the walk. I loved those kilometres from Chaur Bazaar, past Crawford Market, VT Station, Flora Fountain, the Fort area, Regal Circle, and on through Colaba to Sassoon Dock, the World Trade Centre, and the Back Bay. I walked them 1,000 times in those years, and they were always new, always exciting, and always inspiring. As I rounded Regal Circle and paused momentarily to check the coming attractions posters outside Regal Cinema, I heard a voice calling my name.
"Lin Baba! Hey! Oh, Lin!"
I turned to see Prabhakar leaning from the passenger window of a black and yellow taxi. I walked over to shake his hand and greet the driver, Prabhakar's cousin, Shantu.
"We're going back to home. Jump yourself inside and we'll give you a lift."
"Thanks, Prabhu," I smiled. "I'll keep walking. I've got a couple of stops to make along the way."
Okay, Lin, Prabhaka grinned. But you don't take too much time. Like, sometimes too much time you're taking, if you don't mind that I'm telling your face. Today is a special day, isn't it?
I waved until his smile disappeared in the thicket of traffic. But then I jumped in fright as a car slammed to a screeching smash beside me. An ambassador had tried to overtake a slower car and had crashed into a wooden handcart, forcing the heavy cart into the side of a taxi, only 2 meters away from me. It was a bad accident. The handcart puller was seriously injured. I could see that the ropes attached to his neck and shoulders, the reins and harness, had trapped him in the yoke of the cart. His body, constrained by the ropes, had somersaulted, and he'd hit his head hard on the unyielding surface of the road. One arm was twisted backward at a sickeningly unnatural angle. A piece of shinbone on one leg protruded below the knee. And those ropes, the very ropes he used every day to drag his cart through the city, were tangled about his neck and chest, and dragging him toward choking death. I rushed forward with others, pulling my knife from its scabbard in the belt at the back of my trousers. Working fast, but as carefully as possible, I cut through the ropes and freed the man from the wreckage of his cart. He was an older man, perhaps 60 years old, but he was fit and lean and healthy. His fast heartbeat was regular and strong, a powerful current with which to charge his recovery. His airways were clear and he was breathing easily. When I opened his eyes gently with my fingers, his pupils reacted to the light. He was dazed and shocked rather than unconscious. With 3 other men, I lifted him from the road to the footpath. His left arm hung limply from its shoulder, and I eased it into a curve at the elbow. Onlookers donated their handkerchiefs when I called for them. Using 4 of the handkerchiefs, attached at the corners, I confined the arm to his chest in a makeshift sling. I was examining the break in his leg when a frenzy of screaming and shouts near the damaged cars forced me to my feet. 10 or more men were trying to seize the driver of the ambassador. He was a huge man, well over 6 feet, half again as heavy as I was, and twice as broad across the chest. He planted his thick legs against the floor of the vehicle, braced one arm against the roof, and gripped the steering wheel with the other. The furious crowd gave up after a minute of fruitless, desperate struggle, and turned their attention to the man in the back seat. He was a stocky man with strong shoulders, but he was much slighter and leaner. The mob dragged him from the back seat and thrust him against the side of the car. He covered his face with his arms, but the crowd began beating him with their fists and tearing at him with their fingers. The 2 men were Africans. I guessed them to be Nigerians. Watching from the footpath, I remembered the shock and shame I'd felt when I'd seen mob rage like that for the first time, almost 18 months before, on the first day of Prabhakar's dark tour of the city. I remembered how helpless and cowardly I'd felt when the crowd had carried the man's broken body away. I told myself then that it wasn't my culture, it wasn't my city, it wasn't my fight. 18 months later, the Indian culture was mine, and that part of the city was my own. It was a black market beat, my beat. I worked there every day. I even knew some of the people in the murderous crowd. I couldn't let it happen again without trying to help. Shouting louder than the rest, I ran into the screaming crowd and began dragging men away from the tight press of bodies.
"Brothers! Brothers! Don't hit! Don't kill! Don't hit!" I shouted in Hindi.
It was a messy business. For the most part, they allowed me to drag them away from the mob. My arms were strong. The men felt the power that shoved them aside. But their killing rage soon hurled them back into the uproar, and I felt their fists and fingers pounding and gouging at me from everywhere at once. At last I succeeded in clearing a path to the passenger, and then separating him from the leaders of the pack. With his back pressed defensively against the side of the car, the man raised his fists as if ready to fight on. His face was bloody, his shirt was torn and smeared with vivid crimson blood. His eyes were wide and white with fear, and he breathed hard through clenched teeth. Yet there was a determined courage in the set of his jaw, and the scowl that bared his teeth. He was a fighter, and he would fight to the very end.